We have no bill introductions today. Aren't you excited, Senator Breyer?
Oh, shucks. Shucks.
Bill introductions are over.
I said I'm still worn out from yesterday.
I know that.
Yesterday was a hard day. Okay, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 288, Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 288 comes to you at the request of the Senate Judiciary Committee on the Judiciary. It removes the requirement of a parole hearing for someone sentenced to life imprisonment pursuant to ORS 163-105 and 163-115 must be conducted as a contested case hearing. And it's in response to a Supreme Court case, Larson v. the Board of Parole. You have the dash one amendments in front of you, which basically are an emergency clause.
Okay, we have signed up on this. Stephen Powers.
Chair Board, members of the committee, I am Stephen Powers, the chairperson of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 288, which was introduced to remove the requirement of the Administrative Procedures Act, or APA, contested case hearings for this class of hearings called the murder review hearings. I'll first give you a general overview of the board's hearings, talk about the conflict that arose out of the Larson decision, which is actually a Court of Appeals decision, and then get to the substance of 288. Just sort of an overview of the board's hearings in terms of there are 10 different hearings or so that the board conducts. With respect to release hearings, there's the exit interviews for matrix offenders, those that committed their crime before November 1st, 1989.
Can you speak up just a little bit? Thank you.
Matrix offenders who committed their crime before November 1st, 1989, there's exit interviews for them. People who are sentenced as a dangerous offender by the trial court, there are the parole considerations hearings, and then there's this class of murder review hearings, and that's what this bill addresses. The murder review hearings are prescribed in Chapter 163, and in Chapter 163, it directs the board to use the Administrative Procedures Act in Chapter 183. 183, the APA has an exemption for the board. And that's where the conflict is. There's a conflict between directing the board to use the APA or, on the one hand and the APA containing an exemption for the board's hearings. And so the Larson decision, which interpreted in the 1977 version of the murder statute, aggravated murder statute, ultimately said, after going through statutory construction and a long discussion, ultimately says the exemption does not apply to the board. Thus, the board is faced with holding these murder review hearings under the Administrative Procedures Act, which is unlike all the other hearings that I just described, the exit interviews, the parole consideration hearings. Senate Bill 288, its literal effect is just to remove the language that murder review hearings be conducted under the contested procedures in the APA. The reason for this is twofold. First, in looking at the legislative history of Chapter 153, the murder and aggravated murder statutes, it was unclear why this specific subset was singled out to follow the contested case proceedings, whereas the other hearings that the board holds was not singled out in terms of following the APA. Second, the contested case hearings, in the board's view, does not materially enhance an offender's due process protections, but does impose a practical and fiscal burden in as much as we have to develop and have developed a special set of administrative mechanisms under the contested case proceedings for this particular category of cases. It also addresses or raises at least two different concerns with respect to the procedures under the APA, one being the right of a offender for cross-examination for anyone who appears before a board hearing and the right to a subpoena. if I may back up for a second and explain it, other board release hearings, the exit interviews, the parole consideration hearings, after the board has conducted their hearing or as a part of the hearing, then if there's any victim or victim representatives or spokesperson, they may address the board. By statute, then the offender can respond, but that response is directed to the board. Under the contested case proceedings, that procedure has to change. Under the contested case proceedings, there is a right to cross-examination of any person who makes a statement to the board. And so if a victim or victim's representative has made a statement to the board with respect to this murder review hearing, there is that potential for cross-examination between the offender and the victim or victim's family. Additionally, there is the subpoena power under the contested case procedures that raises some concerns. Finally, we are seeking an amendment to add the emergency clause, as you know, and that is because we have about 25 murder review hearings that are in the wings and that are starting. We're actually having our first murder review hearing under the new procedure tomorrow, but there are many more that are coming, as well as a large class of and I tried to pull the numbers before I came here and was unable to do that, of potential murder review hearings that will be coming after they've served their minimum 20 or 30 years, depending on when they committed their crime. And so that's the overview, and there's more, obviously, in my written testimony, but I'm willing to answer any questions that you have.
So what you're saying is before the Larson case, these were not conducted as contested case hearings?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Right. Any questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you appealing the Court of Appeals decision to the Supreme Court?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, no. We did not petition for review of the Larson decision, and that the appellate judgment has issued, and we're going forward with Mr. Larson's case as a contested case hearing for tomorrow.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Stand by. We may have more questions later. Okay. Mary Elledge and Steve Dole, do you want to come up with her? Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, I do. Thank you. My name is Mary Elledge, and I thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm chapter leader of the Greater Portland Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children. I have been chapter leader for over 17 years. I'm also one of the instructors for the Oregon State Victims Assistance Academy. And, of course, the classes I teach are homicide and homicide notification. I do workshops actually across the United States for the POMC conferences on the aftermath of homicide. I'm also, to finish to round up why I'm doing what I do, my son was murdered 20 years ago. My name is, as I so said, is Mary Elledge, and I'm testifying before you today as the chapter leader and the group facilitator of the Greater Portland Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children. And I, as I said, I'm also testifying as the mother of a murdered son. On July 13th, 1986, my son was brutally murdered by three men in our home in Oregon City. The man who planned the murder, we thought, was a best friend of my son's. We've known him since he was a small boy, and he had been a friend of the family. He was a few years older than my son, but he went to school with Rob's older sister. 3 days before Rob was murdered, he came to our house, and as I'm looking at you, he did that same to me. He looked at me and said, I want you to know that Rob is my best friend, and I'm so happy that he's doing so well in college. And he says, hey, is he going to be home this weekend? And I says, are you going to be home this weekend? I says, no, I'm going to be going to the beach. He said, well, he probably would see Rob this weekend. He lured Rob from our home and then came back to hide and wait for him to return with the two men he had hired. He had hired his cousin and another man who had just gotten out of McLaren. Before Rob returned home, the murderer had one of the men hide behind the front door. This man knew how to get into our house without a key because he had been friends so long, and when the kids would forget their keys, many times he was with them. As Rob entered the home, one of the men he hired crushed Rob's head with a baseball bat. He hit him so many times. Rob was still alive and moaning, so this man who planned the murder had another man, the other man that was there, strangle Rob with a telephone cord and inject him with a horse tranquilizer. Rob lived possibly for 40 minutes is what the doctor that did his autopsy said. That was probably the longest he could have lived that way. After he died, they removed his body from our home and buried him in a shallow grave 10 miles from our home. For the weeks that Rob was missing, his friend came over to our house or called almost every day to see where Rob was. He was so worried about him. In 6 weeks after Rob was missing, one of the men was bragging to his friend that they had murdered a young man, and this person went and told the police. They discovered his body, and it took 8 more months before Tony was arrested. Each of these men had hearings and trials. We spoke numerous times before the courts. Going over our son's brutal murder triggered a traumatic grief for our family and for our family's friends. We endured this and all in order that our son receive justice. We have attended all of the parole hearings for each of these men as they were all tried individually. One man was even brought back after 10 years because they found a glitch in his case. Our district attorney could not testify because of the way the case was, how the case was involved, so we had to hire an attorney ourselves. I cannot imagine what our family would have to go through again if the two men who are left in prison would be allowed to have their procedural requirements set up by Larson versus Board of Parole. It would trigger the grief and trauma we faced the first few years after our son's murder. I cannot imagine my family being questioned again about the murders or the murders' attorneys question us. The district attorney in our case has retired. Would that mean that we would have to get our own attorney? Would the state have to get attorneys for the co-victims going to the hearings? If there were not any co-victims, would an attorney be appointed for the murder victim themselves? These questions would have to be addressed. According to author Carrie Freetag, murder breaks all the sacred rules, knows no fairness, and can never be undone or compensated. The aftermath of murder takes us straight through hell, where we stand eye to eye with the evil that hides behind human faces. And what we do in the face of that evil defines what lies behind our own face. The aftermath of murder is nothing less than a full-blown emotional and spiritual struggle. What I'm imploring you is don't make it any harder for the co-victims. Let them choose if they should be there or not. Don't let them be subpoenaed. I have spoken for co-victims who have been unable to speak at the Board of Hearings because they could not hold back their tears so that they could be understood. I cannot imagine if you would ask them to be questioned by the murderer or his or her attorney. Most co-victims suffer from symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. These feelings would be re-experienced if they would be subpoenaed for board hearings. Co-victims now have the choice to speak at hearings or have someone speak for them, or even if they want to attend. Laws need to be made to protect victims and co-victims, not to re-victimize them. Senate Bill 288 would allow the board to continue to give co-victims a voice for their loved ones without punishing them by putting them or their loved ones in a trial situation. Senate Bill 288 gives choices to co-victims who have suffered the worst type of grief, the murder and many times the torture of their loved ones. Homicide cannot be resolved. Respect and a balanced justice system should be a given for co-victims of homicide. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Mr. Dole.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I am president of Crime Victims United. I am here like Mary Ellich because of the murder of my daughter in 1992, Lisa, 15 years ago. I am, too, a member of Parents of Murdered Children and became a member of Crime Victims United 1994 and have been president since 2000. We are here in support of Senate Bill 288, and our concerns are based and rooted in the issue of crime victims' rights. As you all know, we passed statutory provisions for crime victims in the 1980s, in the 1986 election through Senate Bill 10, and we passed Measure 40 in 1996, which was a constitutional bill of rights for crime victims, which were found by the courts because of a technicality to be they were taken out by the Supreme Court, and they were repassed by the people through referral of this body in 1999. The basis upon which our concerns come in is the fact that within those rights, crime victims have the rights to refuse an interview or deposition from the defendant or from the convicted. They also have a right to be present at, informed of, and speak at all hearings. And last but not least, they have the right to be reasonably protected throughout all proceedings from arrest through release. Under the present law, these rights are being abridged, and they would create a tension during these parole hearings because of the confrontations that can happen between the victims and the convicted, and we believe it also have a chilling effect on victims or their representatives, I should say co-victims, the family members of the murder victim in this case, showing up for these proceedings in the first place. With that, again, we are in support of 288. We think that it should be that the law should be amended. Thank you very much. And I'll take any questions you might have.
Just a comment for the record. Measure 40 was not thrown out on a technicality. The court ruled that it had 8 separate measures within one constitutional amendment. And when 7 of those were referred to the ballot, only 4 of those, as I recall, passed. So it was way more than a technicality.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Becky Duncan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here. For the record, my name is Becky Duncan. I'm an attorney with the Office of Public Defense Services. We oppose Senate Bill 288 in its current form. We have 3 concerns that we would like to draw your attention to. The first one is a concern about fairness, specifically the fairness of the retroactive application of this bill. The second one is a concern about the significance of this as a change in policy, and we want to make sure that the committee is aware of the scope of this change. The third one is a concern about the precision, or more accurately, the lack of precision in this bill. And I'll address those 3 things in turn, but first would like to put my comments in context. What we're talking about today are sentences in murder cases. What you need to know is that sentences in murder cases, unlike sentences in many other cases, are prescribed by statute, specifically the 2 statutes at issue in the bill before you, ORS 163-105 and ORS 163-115. And what those statutes provide is that, essentially, a person convicted of murder gets a life sentence. After that person has served a minimum term, that person can request a hearing. That hearing is to determine whether or not the person is likely to be rehabilitated within a reasonable period of time. If the person establishes, and the person bears the burden of establishing, that he's likely to be rehabilitated, then the sentence is converted from life, essentially without the possibility of parole, to life with the possibility of parole or post-prison supervision. So what we're talking about is the hearing and the procedural requirements for this rehabilitation hearing. If you would, in the bill itself, I draw your attention to lines 21 and 22 on the first page. When the legislature created this statutory scheme for murder sentences, they inserted this hearing requirement, and they specifically provided how the hearing was to be conducted. And on lines 21 and 22 of Senate Bill 288, you will see that the legislature provided that the proceeding shall be conducted in the manner prescribed for a contested case hearing under ORS Chapter 183, except that, and then it has two exceptions. And so what's different about murder review hearings than other board hearings is that this is an instance where the legislature itself said, we want these hearings conducted in a certain manner. And that manner was in the manner prescribed for a contested case hearing under this Chapter 183. And that chapter is the Administrative Procedures Act, which Mr. Powers of the board referenced. So what the legislature did was say, we want murder review hearings conducted like contested case hearings under the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act. And what you should be aware of is that the Administrative Procedures Act contains certain requirements to ensure that the agency, whether it's the Board of Parole or some other, for example, licensing agency, conducts their hearings in a certain way. The purpose of that is to ensure that the agency has the information that it needs and to ensure that the hearings proceed in a manner to ensure fairness. The requirements include that the person who's the subject of the hearing get notice of the hearing and notice of how it's going to proceed, that the person has the ability to call material witnesses, and it's only material witnesses, not any witnesses, and that if the person is going to call material witnesses and ask the agency to subpoena them, that the person make a general showing of relevance and reasonable scope. So they're not free to just subpoena anyone. Another important provision of the contested case rules is that irrelevant, immaterial, or unduly repetitious evidence shall be excluded. That's a basic requirement that the legislature saw fit to put in the murder review hearings. So basically, when the legislature created the statutory sentencing scheme, they intended to have basic requirements to ensure that the board had the information it needed and that it conducted the hearings in a fair manner, hearing relevant but excluding irrelevant evidence. And so that's what this statute currently provides for, and that is the provision that the board's seeking to eliminate in Senate Bill 288. And that gives us some pause. We're here today, this bill is here today, because there was an inmate, Mr. Larson, who asserted that the board was required to comply with the contested case requirements. The board said that it wasn't. The Court of Appeals looked at the language of the statute and the legislative history of the statute and said, Mr. Larson, you're right, the board is required to conduct hearings in this manner. And so, back in June of last year, the Court of Appeals sent Mr. Larson's case back to the board for a proper murder review hearing. The board has yet to hold that hearing, although I understand that that's scheduled to be held tomorrow. And as Senator Breyer pointed out, the board did not challenge the Court of Appeals' interpretation of the law that applied to Mr. Larson. And so we have concerns because, in addition to Mr. Larson, there are other cases, there are other inmates who made the same challenge who said, the board is supposed to comply with the contested case requirement. There are at least three other inmates who have won their cases in the Court of Appeals but have yet to have their hearings by the board. And the effect of this legislation, especially because it has an emergency clause, would be to undo what the Court of Appeals ruled in those cases for these people after they've successfully made the challenge. They said the law requires this. The Court of Appeals said you're right. And now the board seeks to change the law and apply it to a group of people, including these people. So that's our first fairness concern with this statute. Our second concern is more general, and it is just we would like the committee to be fully aware of the scope of this change. As I've pointed out, the murder review hearing is a product of statute that the legislature intentionally put in there. It's clear from the text that they wanted these hearings to be conducted in the manner of a contested case. The reason is because it ensures that the information the board needs is there and that they're conducted fairly. And so We would urge that the committee be cautious in eliminating these basic requirements that ensure proper information come before the board and that the hearings be conducted fairly. Our third related concern is about the precision or lack thereof of this bill. I understand from the testimony today that there are concerns about cross-examination of co-victims or subpoenaing of these people. But as I pointed out, the APA has many different requirements intended to ensure fairness, one of which is excluding irrelevant evidence. If there are particular parts of the APA that the board thinks should not apply to a murder review hearing, then I would suggest that the board offer the committee, identify those provisions to the committee. I would certainly point out that this is not a situation where people are going to be required to come in and recount the details of a murder, and that if that perhaps cross-examination of the representatives of victims could be excluded, but there is no reason to, as the board has suggested, eliminate all of the contested requirement, contested case requirements here. It is a broad response to what appears to be a narrow concern. So in general, we have concerns about the retroactive application of this to people who've already been told by the Court of Appeals that the law, based on what the legislature intended, guarantees them or entitles them to a contested case, but now they're at risk of being deprived of that. And then, two, that it just eliminates requirements that the legislature intended to make these hearings fair. And third, that it could certainly be more precise to address the specific issues that the board thinks could be a problem in these murder review hearings. Thank you for the opportunity to talk. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to provide whatever answers I can.
Thank you. Senator Pozanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'll come questions and some comments regarding the contested case requirement. I mean, that's just a procedural position that the court has interpreted what the statute applies or what it says is it thought that we intended.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, this body has gone through where courts have made decisions and we have changed the law to get out from the interpretation to make clear whatever we wanted. And I'm wondering, one, if you ever looked at the legislative history regarding the current law, and did it actually say we wanted to have contested case hearing applied?
I'm relying on the text of it and the Court of Appeals interpretation. I have not gone back to this language that's been in place at least since 1977. I have not, but could certainly go back to archives and find out what was said at the committee hearings or minutes.
Okay, and I think the other part that concerned me in hearing the previous witness give testimony, I mean, on subpoenas, and I understand that there are certain rules that need to be required, such as material witnesses only. Can you please tell me in what circumstances would a family member of a murder victim would ever be, quote unquote, a material witness in a decision as to whether or not someone should be granted parole?
Senator Burdick, Senator Pozanski, the issue in this hearing is only whether the person is capable of rehabilitation. That's what the statute says, and that's how the court has interpreted it. So we cannot envision any situation where a defendant could assert that the family member of the murder victim is a material witness. We can't see how that person would have anything to say about, to say on the defendant's behalf, to prove his burden, which is that he's capable of, likely to be rehabilitated within a reasonable time. We don't see that category of witnesses as being material to what's at issue in this hearing. That said, they could come and state their position, but the issue that the defendant has to prove is that he's capable of rehabilitation. And so we would expect, and what we've seen is inmates seeking to have witnesses like pastors or people that they've worked with in the correctional institution or people who have known them since and have something to say about whether they're capable of being rehabilitated. But we don't see this as an avenue to bring in the families of victims.
So if I can follow up.
Please.
So that would tell me that you would agree that if a defendant, someone that's in prison, wanted to subpoena a family member, that the board itself could basically, if they were, let's say, given a requirement to review any subpoenas that before they are issued to determine whether they're material or not. Could just Cardabon say you're not going to get to subpoena that
certainly
person?
Certainly. And I'd point that authority already exists in the Administrative Procedures Act. The person can subpoena only material witnesses, and if the person is subpoenaing them through the board, looking for the exact language.
Well, let me just cut to the chase on this. It seems to me that maybe all subpoenas that are going to be issued on behalf of a prisoner shouldn't go through the board for review to determine whether or not they find that the request of that individual is, reaching the threshold of material. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
All right. The other thing is that if a family member of a murder victim decided to come forward and give testimony as to why they think this individual has not been rehabilitated, do you think that opens the door for the individual or their attorney to basically, quote-unquote, bring back the past of the incident itself? I mean, to me, it seems like that's moot, and we would actually be at the point of saying that decision was already made by that jury that right. determined their guilt, and at this point, all we're here to determine is whether or not, since the time you've been incarcerated, whether or not you have demonstrated that you have rehabilitated to the point of being released on some type of release.
Right. That's the only issue, and I don't think this will lead to a relitigation of the facts of the underlying conviction.
Lastly, if I could.
Please.
Do you know of any cases where the board has allowed for that type of cross-examination to occur involving one of these type of hearings?
No, it has. No, I'm not aware of any cases where that's happened.
But also the board has been interpreting the contested
right.
case hearing not to apply.
Right.
So we
right.
don't know.
Right.
I don't know that they would interpret it that way, but it's never happened because the board hasn't thought cross-examination was allowed at all.
Yeah, I'm not sure where we're going to go with the bill, but clearly I want to, if we're looking at the contested case hearings to continue, that we put some sideboards and parameters mm-hmm. in place to make certain that we don't have individuals being wrongfully subpoenaed for no purpose, that's where they're not material, and that whatever information they may come forward to volunteer as to why they think the person should not be released on some type of parole, that they are not going to be subject to reliving a situation that has already been adjudicated.
I'd like to bring Mr. Powers back to the dais. I have a couple questions. Thank you. Why don't you stay there? We'll just so we can question both of you. How are the hearings done now? I mean, how have you been doing with under your interpretation that a contested hearing contested case hearing is not required? How have you been doing it up till now?
It models a lot of the Administrative Procedures Act in terms of notice of excluding irrelevant material. And so a notice packet is given to an offender within 14 days and ensure that, you know, the basis of the hearing is there, that the evidence is there, and the offender has the ability to present testimony and also have a spokesperson, inmate legal assistant, or, you know, if they're represented, they're available at the hearing. And the board conducts an interview going through the administrative rule factors for whether they're capable of rehabilitation, and the offender has the ability to make a statement, broad ranging, you know, what do you want to tell the board on how you're going to meet your burden. And so that's how the hearing has been conducted. When there are victims or victim representatives there at the after that portion of the hearing is completed, the board turns to the victim or victim's representative and allows them to make a statement to the board, and then by statute the offender has an opportunity to respond, but we make sure that's directed to the board. I've just been at the board since February 5th, and I have seen where offenders have turned to the victim and said, that's not true, whatever you have said, and we've had to redirect the conversation to please address your comments to the board.
But under your current system, the prisoner does not get to subpoena anybody?
Correct.
Okay, and so the contested case would give them that kind of subpoena power with requirements that it be material, et cetera.
Correct, but it's not screened by the board unless someone brings it to the board's attention. For someone who isn't represented, the offender cannot issue the subpoena on their own, and so the offender can request that the board issue the subpoena on their behalf, his or her behalf.
Under a contested case.
Right. If the offender is represented, that subpoena does not go through the board, and that would be automatically issued by the offender's attorney to the victim, and it would be up to the victim to bring it to the attention to the board to quash that subpoena if that's what they wanted to do.
Now, let me repeat that again. That would be the case under a contested case
hearing
where the defendant's attorney could do it without involving the board.
Then
in order to quash it, the victim would have to independently contact the board and say this doesn't meet the requirements?
Right. Essentially bring a motion before the board.
Okay. Counsel?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm looking at Article 1, Section 42, subsection, let's see, 1C, the right to refuse an interview, deposition, or other discovery request. That's a right of the victim under the Victim's Right Initiative, which Mr. Dole mentioned. So what it basically means, this trumps the APA.
Mm-hmm.
So the victim would have a right to say, I don't want to be interviewed, I don't want to have a deposition.
Thank you for that research. So what is the problem here? What problem are you trying to solve by getting rid of the contested case?
Trying to harmonize the murder review hearings with the rest of the hearings that the board has conducted. The other exit interviews and parole consideration hearings that I mentioned earlier, those procedures provide the necessary due process concerns for an offender to present the information that they need for the board to make its decision, and that the murder review hearings are singled out for the APA treatment that, in our view of research of the 1977 legislative history, didn't show any demonstrable reason why those two were tagged together. And so it's to harmonize how the board conducts all of its hearings.
So this would square the murder and aggravated murder review hearings with all other types of hearings?
Right. The exception in the APA that exempts the board from the subpoena, the material witnesses, those type of notice requirements in the APA wouldn't apply to the board in all of its hearings if this bill is passed.
Wait. Run that by again.
Basically, because what Larson faced was a chicken and an egg problem. There was in the murder statute, an aggravated murder statute, it said conduct the hearing under APA.
Mm-hmm.
In the APA, there was an exemption for the board's hearings, and it was which one came first. Ultimately, Larson's and the decision in the Larson opinion said the APA's direction trumps the exception. What this bill would do is say the exception trumps any direction, and therefore the board's hearings would all be the same, whether it's an exit interview or a murder review hearing.
Madam Chair, I think what happened more than likely is that when they passed the stuff that was just the general blanket exception, then the court looked and saw that in this particular statute we said that the APA would apply, and so they said that we must have been making a decision intentionally wanting to go that route for those type. And the only thing I would say is that if the others stand constitutional muster, why shouldn't we use the same procedure in all of these type of reviews, and why have a separate APA review for a particular class versus another if it stands constitutional muster?
Counsel, did you have a comment?
I'm sure Senator Prezansky is right. What happened is you had a specific statute and a general statute.
Mm-hmm.
The specific as it applies to murder cases, the general as it applies to all hearings. They were evidently passed different times without consideration of each other, and what the courts did using the rules of construction said the specific overrules the general. That's why we're here.
Well, and the later one overrules the earlier one. Is that part of it?
They didn't get there, but if I remember correctly, the specific was later than the general.
Okay. Are there other questions or comments from the committee? Thank you. We will close this hearing and mull this over and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 322. Counsel.
Madam Chair, we have to switch counsels. Okay.
Do you have 501?
That's the only one I have.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. Great. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 322. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 322 comes at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon Law Commission. It clarifies judgment lien priority exemptions in multiple judgments and writs of execution, deficiency judgments of foreclosures, and money awards. It also establishes guidelines for sheriff involvement with levies on personal property. There was an amendment. Should be in front of the committee members.
You have it.
Yeah.
You need a copy. Yeah. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Barr.
Thank you. Just to a question of the council, I guess. And this is it. I didn't know we'd already acted upon this bill.
Yeah, I saw the A2.
Oh, I'm sorry. My apologies.
I saw A, and I'm going, what did we already do?
How did it get back so quick?
Okay, that's a quintessential optimism.
Scrivener's error.
So it's Scrivener's error, and let the record show that. This bill has, this is its first hearing. Okay, continue on. Council?
No.
You're done?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, we have Gerald Watson from the Oregon Law Commission. And John, did you want to come up with him? John DiLorenzo as well. And Dave Hendricks, got the whole works here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner in the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I am here today in my capacity as the most junior member of the Oregon Law Commission. I hope that doesn't have anything to do with the reason why I was asked to chair the Committee on Judgments, but here I am, and I did in fact chair that committee of the Oregon Law Commission. It was a great committee. I learned a great deal. We had wonderful representation of both creditors' attorneys and debtors' attorneys, and representation by the sheriffs who are in fact charged with enforcement of many of these judgments. We're here today on two bills, Senate Bill 322, which is currently before you, which contain technical revisions, including examples would be types of provisions that allow sheriffs to request instructions from the court as to specifically how to perform their writs of execution. In addition, there will be later Senate Bill 501, which primarily deals with standardized terminology. In 2005, the Legislative Assembly dealt with and approved two bills, House Bill 2359, which related to judgments, and Senate Bill 920, which related to judicial sales. And in March of last year, the Commission acknowledged that several of the cross-references were off, and there were technical issues that had been created and authorized the creation of the committee, which I chair. The committee, again, consisted of many members, several of whom are here today. David Hendricks with Legislative Council, Legislative Council statutorily assigned as staff of the Oregon Law Commission, and so David shepherded the preparation of the drafts, and he will explain point by point, or as the chair requests, the bills. Also, Professor Gerald Watson from Willamette University is all the way to the right, and he is one of the several staff members for the commission. Jim Nass is also here and will be presenting testimony. He's from the Oregon Judicial Department and is the proponent of the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 322, which we support. In addition, Mark Comstock is here with the Garrett Heeman firm, and Marshall Ross with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office will be giving some testimony, all in support of the bill. And with that, I would like to suggest that you maybe hear from Dave Hendricks to summarize the bills and go from there. And I also, if possible, will need to leave in about 10 minutes because I unfortunately scheduled another appointment. But I sure appreciate the opportunity to be here and to introduce our Oregon Law Commission bills to you.
John, are you also, do your general comments apply to Senate Bill 501 as well?
Yes, they do.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and also open a public hearing on Senate Bill 501 and ask that the record reflect that these comments that we just heard are also associated with that bill. And that will give us a little more freedom to go back and forth.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from the Legislative Council's office. Both of these bills are a little bit of a mishmash because they kind of go across a wide range of little areas where there have been little tweaks, little clarifications, et cetera. Many of them arising out of the bills that we have, the Law Commission had brought to you over the last three sessions. Starting with the garnishment rewrite and with the major judgment rewrite, and then last session with the bill relating to judicial sales. Most of these things do fall in the category of clarification rather than an error, but in some of them they're important clarifications. In Senate Bill 322, the first section is a very important clarification because it has to do with the priority of a judgment lien over a recorded instrument. And we actually had this in the bill last session. There was still some issues about whether or not the language adequately reflected the fact that the general rule would be that if you want your, if you've got a deed or a contract of sale, you better record it if you want to protect your interest against a judgment that comes against that property. And the language that we've added in that section will make that very clear that that's what was intended. That's what we think it said, but we'll eliminate any question on those points. And I will leave it up to you about how much detail you want on the rest of this because they are fairly detailed in small items. Probably the more significant things, we have a new section that directly relates to the sheriff's ability to use force in entry, doing an entry for purposes of enforcing execution?
Order in aid.
Order in aid of execution. That is very significant to the sheriffs. They like to have lots of clarity with respect to what their authority is and what they're supposed to do, and so it was a good addition to go back and bring that forward so that they had a provision that directly addressed that.
Okay, when you, I assume you're talking about the material on page 10?
It's actually on page 9. The court.
It starts on page 9. And
right, the court order for entry of premises.
Right, why don't you go into a little more detail on that, if you would. The problem that's being addressed and how this addresses it.
The issue, and the sheriff here is going to be able to address this a little more than I can from what was happening before. I think the issue is primarily was that there was no clear mechanism for how a creditor could basically get approval for the sheriff to forcibly entry when they had a creditor who just said, no, you know, I'm not going to let you in the house. And we actually had this discussion as part of the bill relating to the garnishment bill because they have exactly the same issue with garnishments where you have a person who just says, no, I'm not going to let you into my house. And what the sheriff wanted and what the bill basically provides is a procedure for the judgment creditor to go forward with an ex parte motion. You know, they don't... And it has to be ex parte because the whole idea is to allow the person to go in and not have them moving the property before the sheriff can seize it, to do an ex parte order requesting that the sheriff authorizes the sheriff to use such force as necessary to enter a structure. And this basically provides, you know, that once you get that order, something from the court saying, yes, you have that authority to deliver that to the sheriff, who then is directed to comply with that and to use such force as is necessary. It's always a touchy thing because on the one hand, you have to at some point be able to say, yes, this is the court's order and it's going to be enforced. On the other hand, the sheriff is always going to use some discretion when they come up against the person with a gun, et cetera, where, you know, what steps they're going to take. I don't think that happens very often. The sheriff can tell you more about those scenarios. But that's what it does. It provides that procedure.
Okay, and how have they been doing it until now?
I believe it's probably been done in a variety of ways in different counties. And I suspect it depends a lot on how the sheriff is. Again, I think, isn't that correct? The sheriff is nodding yes back there, that it is probably done a lot of different ways. This way provides for a new court order. If you look at the writ itself, I think some of those writs that are out there that have issued before probably on their face purport to say that the sheriff has that authority. What this does is say, look, before the sheriff has to go in and do that, there's another step in the process, and a court has to sign off on it.
Okay. All right, and we do have Sheriff. We do have a sheriff signed up somewhere here.
Ross is here.
Sheriff Ross is
sheriff
here.
Sheriff Ross
from Multnomah County.
That's right. Okay. Okay. Is that it for you?
Yeah. If you want me to, I'll briefly address Senate Bill 501 as well.
Okay, that'd be great.
Technically, these two bills probably could have been part of one, but the material on Senate Bill 501 came in too late to get into this one, so we drafted up another bill. Just does two simple little things. It does a little clarification on what the money award is that attorneys are supposed to write into the judgment form. Under the laws, we passed it back in 2003, it just said the amount of the money award, and that was a little confusing for the courts because the money award technically includes everything that's awarded under the judgment, and yet there were a bunch of additional things in the statute that seemed to be in addition to the money award. Very confusing. So we just clarified that this is basically the principal amount exclusive of these other amounts that might be added. And then finally, the rest of the bill essentially renames what was called in our 2003 bill the separate record, which is a pretty nondescript term, to basically give a little more clarity. It is the judgment lien record. It's basically the if you have a judgment and the clerk enters it into the judgment lien record, it creates a judgment lien. So it's a very clean sort of structure, and that's where the title companies look to see if a property has clear record. They look in that. It used to be called the docket back before 2003. This is just a much more descriptive name for what it is. And that's all I have to say.
Okay. I'm going to ask our counsel here or any member of the committee, if there are other specific parts of this bill that we need to tap Mr. Hendricks' expertise on in more detail.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Mr. Hendricks, both bills amend ORS 18-235 and in different ways. These amendments of the same statute are not in conflict with each other.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, no. Our office has a very sophisticated conflict checking system, and even if they were on the face of it in conflict with each other, when the bills got to the second chamber and were ready to come out of the final committee, it's at that point we run conflict checks and fix those sort of problems with a separate amendment back to the committee. These two here, actually, though I looked at them quickly beforehand, and they actually work fine the way they are, can be put together without a conflict amendment at the end of the process.
Thank you. So the Law Commission just amended the same statute in two different ways and didn't catch it.
I think it was a relating clause problem. Is that it?
That's because I got a rookie.
I think it was the chair.
Chair, if I can defend myself. Actually, they are two different subjects. Now that I have refreshed my recollection, and the information came in and was presented to our committee at two different times, and both bills required an amendment of a different type to the same statute, and that is my recollection of what occurred.
I just double checked the relating clause, and they are both indeed relating. They have the same relating clause. So.
It could be one bill.
It could be one.
It's more of a timing issue than anything.
All right. Well, okay. Any other questions, comments from the committee?
I'm just, Madam Chair, I don't think we're ever going to be done with judgments and garnishments. We're constantly fixing them up and cleaning them up. So
I just had this sense of sitting next to Senator Walker, of her feeling of longing for her time on the commission.
Well, Mr. DiLorenzo took my spot, so he's done an able job.
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator Walker brings up a point. I mean, at some point in time, it seems like courts have interpreted the laws we have. And is that when the law commission looks at things and says, well, now there's no more lawsuits to be filed on that section, so we got to change it so we can get more work for our lawyers so they can file lawsuits on that section?
I believe you're a volunteer. Is that correct, Mr. DiLorenzo?
I certainly am. And also, there will not be a shortage of junior members of the commission, and each junior member, I'm sure, will end up with the judgments committee.
That's great. Okay. Mr. Watson, did you have anything to add?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Jerry Watson, senior, special counsel to the Oregon Law Commission. I would be happy to contribute anything that you would like with regard to an overview on these bills, but I don't feel the need to do so. The report outlines are basically about 10 topics, 9 topics, depending on how you want to cut it, that are discussed across 322. As Dave explained, 501, SB 501 taps in and picks up one of those topics on money awards and deals with a further aspect of it, and tackles the other issue of a separate record. We do have three individuals, each of whom have some written testimony, as well as would be happy to make any specific comments based upon their expertise in dealing with these areas, and I would defer to them and be happy to answer any of the questions if you have them.
We'll move on to our next panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for coming. Jim Nass, Mark Comstock, and Marshall Ross.
My committee got me sick.
Welcome.
You're blaming me. Every place we go, you blame me.
You sit next to me in
We're trying to harass poor Senator Cruz here. Okay, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the Oregon Appellate Courts. This bill deals more with matters that affect the trial courts. I've been asked to speak to the amendment, and I'm willing to do so, but please be merciful and don't ask me any questions about what goes on in the trial courts. Our only concern with Senate Bill 322 has to do with Section 5 of that bill. And Section 5 of that bill states a very sensible proposition that the amount owing on a judgment at any given point in time includes the original amount that the trial court included in the judgment, includes any interest that has been accruing since then. It may also include costs that the judgment creditor has incurred that have not been satisfied from whatever writ was issued, and does not include, or that is to say that the amount owing may be lessened by any voluntary payments that the judgment debtor has made or any proceeds from sale. So it's just basically stating a rule of how do you account for these funds. The concern we have is that, and then this was brought to us by our trial court staff, is that they were concerned that they would be asked to compute the amount owing at any given time. Historically, this is not something that trial court clerk staff has done. There are procedures in place that in the event that there's a dispute between the judgment debtor and the judgment creditor, that they can go to the trial judge and have the judge rule on that. So the function of this amendment is simply to make clear that parties cannot call upon trial court staff to determine the amount owing on a judgment at any given point in time.
Okay, and if I heard correctly, the law commission supports this amendment. Is that correct?
That is correct, Jeff.
Okay. Is that it? Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Who's next? Mr. Comstock.
Chair Burdick, my name is Mark Comstock. I come to the committee with a little over 25 years of experience in the trenches in the debtor-creditor area, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions to the extent I can and maybe explain what does go on in the trial courts in this area and what happens in the field. Other than that, I'd be pleased to rely on the written comments.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for your service on this work group. It sounded like a very detailed proposition through here. Are there questions of Mr. Comstock right now from the committee? Thank you. Now we can find out the real truth about these liens. Mr. Ross.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Marshall Ross with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. I've been, I'm a supervisor in the civil unit, and I've been with Multnomah County in the civil enforcement for almost 19 years. The Oregon Law Commission had two members of two deputies who are supervisors in civil units, deputy leader from Washington County, and myself on the judicial subcommittee work group, and we're very receptive to issues concerning sheriffs. Two issues that are of great concern to sheriffs. First off is the court order for entry of premises where the most recent case decisions we have had, most recently from the federal courts, is that the sheriff is a ministerial officer and the court should be telling a sheriff where to search and what to seize. This is to protect our citizens from unreasonable search and seizure by the police. There is no easy mechanism in law or in the execution statutes for a creditor to go to court and get an order telling the sheriff where to go, what to seize, and what authority a sheriff has in executing their writ of execution. We have some outlying statutes in ORS 206. One says that if an order directs a sheriff to use to seize property at a specific premises, then the sheriff shall demand the return, publicly demand the return, and if not, forcibly enter the building or enclosure and seize the property. We have another statute that says that a sheriff is immune if the document presented to the sheriff is regular on its face and appears issued by competent authority. With those two statutes, there's been a variety of practices going on in the state. Writs of execution are generally issued by a clerical member of the court staff, simply reviewing if there is the existence of a judgment and stamping it and issuing it out to a sheriff. Some creditors will put the location of the property in that writ. Some sheriffs will go out and take that as the court's blessing, that is the address to which a sheriff is entitled to search and seize. Search and seize. It actually has not gone through any judicial review. It's just been issued by the court clerical staff. This mechanism would give creditors the ability to go to court, make a showing to the court, and then give an order to a sheriff from the court that directs the sheriff to a specific address for a specific purpose to seize specific property based upon a specific showing. Another issue in Section 18 of this is the creditor's bond requirement, where a sheriff can ask for a bond, an indemnity bond, to protect the sheriff from any liability claims. The current statute is permissive, and we have 36 sheriffs doing 36 different practices. It's driving the creditors crazy. It's also making it hard for the sheriffs. This section clarifies and gives the sheriffs more of a rule that we can follow so that we don't have to be using discretion and having variety all over the place among the 36 different sheriffs. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Questions?
Starting to count on you.
Questions? Not on this side. They're talking. Seeing no questions, thank you. Does anybody else like to testify on these bills? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearings on Senate Bill 322 and Senate Bill 501, and we shall sit here and wait for a minute.
It's rebelled against me. I think we're through our witness list. The public hearing has been closed, despite the fact that I had 45 additional questions. But Just kidding, record.
Did you lose?
I don't know.
It moves under my arm.
These look, actually, could we reopen for just a half second? I did have a question I wanted to ask the sheriff here. We'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 322. I just wanted to get some clarity on how, when you get the order and you go into the property, you have a specific piece of property that you're after. It's not a general thing where you go in and you try to find what you can find them in. How specific are these orders?
A creditor must give the sheriff specific instructions as to what property the sheriff is to levy on, and they have to provide an adequate description to where we call it the dumb deputy rule. The dumbest deputy has to be able to look at the paper, look at the property, and identify it as the property we're going to seize.
Okay, thank you. See, committee, if we hadn't reopened, we would never have found out about the dumb deputy rule. Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? And just to review, before this happened, your authority was unclear because you didn't have the actual judicial review. Is that correct?
There is another statute that's ORS 206030 that says if a sheriff is directed to seize property at a specific location by order, that we can enter after making an announcement to enter a request for the return of the property. How that order was coming to the sheriff was problematic. Sometimes it was just issued by a member of the court clerical staff. It was not issued by a judge. Many sheriffs are very skeptical of that. It was just a clerical stamp and not an order by a reviewing authority telling the sheriff, yes, you may proceed at this property.
Okay. Thank you for answering those questions. Any other questions from the committee, council? Okay, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 322, and I assume the hearing on 501 is also closed. And I think I'll just open a work session since the committee seems very eager on these two bills. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 322. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment in the Senate Bill 322.
Senator Beyer has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 322. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 322 as amended to the Senate floor as a do pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 322 to the Senate floor as amended with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, for the good old times, would you like to carry this bill?
Yeah, I can do that.
Senator Walker, you are a sport. We may even give you the next one. Okay, Senator Walker will carry that bill. Now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 501, which I do not believe has amendments with it. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 501 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 501 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this one as well? They're so related.
Well, I'm going to try to make judgments and garnishments exciting to listen to.
That's wonderful. If anyone can do it, you can do it, Senator Beyer. If any other business before the committee, we're adjourned.
That's going to be some creative writing.
Yeah.